Captain Leonard Howard, the Admiral's jag. Fuck me. No, fuck him, bro. His visits with the Imam stopped just before you guys got ambushed overseas. They haven't met together since. Reese had another name to add to his list. This thing looks like a target package, Reese stated, taking the thick file from Ben and beginning to leaf through it. That's because it is, bro. Everything you need is in there. The Imam that Howard met with is Hamadi Ismail Massoud. He lives in the mosque. It is more of a mini compound, really, though surprisingly open. You would think they would be a bit more security conscious. They call it the Islamic Center for Peace and Prosperity of Southern California. The mosque should clear out Wednesday after Ishu. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, evening prayer.
When does it go down this time of year? 9:30. It will be fairly packed, but we'll empty out quickly. I've already set you up with an alias and a backstory. You even have an appointment with Massoud after prayer, so you have 2 days to get ready. Reese eyed Ben quizzically.
That's not really my style.
Trust me, this will work. This is what I do now, remember?
What, set up assassinations of Islamic clergy on U.S. soil?
Reese, we missed this one. We had this guy in our sights for over a year, and we missed it. If we hadn't, maybe your troop would still be alive. Your government let you down. We knew this guy was as bad as they come. Outwardly, he condemns terrorism and is the face of moderate Islam in Southern California, posting videos on YouTube disparaging Islamic extremists and calling for an end to violence. In reality, his group is a conduit for funneling money to ISIS. I'm talking millions of dollars. While he preaches peace, his money helps ISIS behead Americans on camera for the world to see.
I thought ISIS was focused on Iraq, Syria, and the Levant. Why would Howard go through an ISIS guy to set up an attack in Afghanistan?
Don't be fooled, bro. Al-Qaeda and ISIS are not as far apart ideologically as it would seem. It's all about the caliphate, man. 12th century shit. ISIS used to be AQ in Iraq, remember?
Oh, I remember,
Reese said, thinking of the blood and energy he and his men had invested in hunting them down over the years. But I thought they had a very public split not long ago.
Well, they did.
ISIS is the new kid on the block, very popular and far surpassing AQ in fundraising. That, along with their vicious attacks on Shia and even moderate Sunnis, have run counter to more recent AQ proclamations of Islamic unity. They appeal to the next generation of jihadi and are much more adept at recruiting, specifically using social media, than AQ ever was. AQ's message was to join up because Islamic lands are under attack by the West. ISIS flipped it around.
Their messaging is all about being on the offensive.
Very powerful stuff and something we haven't even begun to counter.
That doesn't answer the question as to why Howard and Pilsner used them instead of AQ or Taliban.
That question is exactly why they went the ISIS route, to throw people off the track. Logically, it would make sense to use an AQ or Taliban-affiliated network, but if you want to throw up a roadblock, use ISIS.
Unbelievable,
Reese said, shaking his head. Recently, ISIS and AQ leadership have recognized the power of collaboration. They can be a much more effective force if their energies are focused on destroying us instead of each other. Pilsner and Howard have access to the same intelligence channels that I do, and they would have known the same thing. ISIS and AQ can channel resources and kill us today, then work out their differences tomorrow.
So the government wants Massoud dead and you figured I'm a good guy to get it done?
Not exactly, brother. Though he does need to die. This guy has funded more terrorism than the blind sheik ever could have hoped to back in the day, yet he promotes himself as a moderate Muslim, denouncing all violence and terrorism. He was the connection to the Pakistani Taliban who planned and executed the ambush of your troop in Afghanistan. I know you are going to take him down. Least I can do is help. My superiors don't know anything about this. It's totally off the books.
So how does the alias and backstory work?
Reese asked, back on task. You are a graduate student at USD in international business and have an elective world comparative religion class. You want to interview Massoud for a paper you are writing on world religions and politics. Part of the mandate for their Islamic Center is outreach, so this is not an odd request. They are very open and inviting. I have Massoud's cell and center business phone numbers under surveillance. If he calls to check out your creds at USD, I divert the call and confirm your enrollment in graduate school. Ben smiled, obviously quite proud of himself. And do me a favor, Ben continued, handing Reese a small package. Leave this with the fucker when you kill him. Wish I could go with you on this one, buddy. Hypocrites drive me crazy. Reese had checked and double-checked his gear for the next phase of his mission of vengeance. All there was to do now was wait. But there was somewhere that he needed to go first. He steered his cruiser through a quiet neighborhood and parked at a small church, continuing on foot. The streets were deserted at this late hour. Anyone attempting to follow him in a vehicle would be easy to spot. Still, he took an indirect route, winding his way through a maze of residential streets, the silence broken only by the occasional barking dog. His path took him down an alley where he stopped and pretended to tie his shoe. Satisfied that no one was behind him, he cut between two homes and paused at the base of a large eucalyptus tree. Grabbing onto the lowest branch, he scrambled up the trunk and straddled a massive fork. Taking off his pack, Reese removed his bump helmet with its attached NODs, securing them to his head. The dark suburban scene was suddenly bright green through his goggles, thanks to the amplified illumination of the half-moon and stars. He scooted out on the branch until his feet dangled over a wooden privacy fence. Taking advantage of his night vision and his elevated perch, Reese carefully scanned the area for any sign of movement. Seeing nothing out of place, he swung his leg over the limb and dropped into the soft grass of his backyard. Drawing the Glock from his waistband, Reese moved to a knee and took in the scene silently for a full 2 minutes. The house was dark and appeared from the outside to be undisturbed since he'd last left it. He walked across the yard and peered over the side gate toward the front of the house, where he saw Lauren's Cherokee in the driveway and the police tape still strung around the massive eucalyptus that had been the centerpiece of his lawn. The base of the tree had been converted into a makeshift shrine by the neighbors, with cards, handwritten notes, candles, and stuffed animals covering a significant portion of the front yard. Reese holstered his Glock and activated the IR illumination on the side of his helmet before retrieving a Strider SMF folding knife from his pants pocket. Seeing no sign of a booby trap, Reese slipped the knife's blade between the upper and lower panes to the window of his small guest room, disengaging the lock. Here goes nothing. Reese slid the lower pane upward. The window opened easily. Nothing exploded. Reese exhaled in relief. He took off his pack and lowered it through the window. 20 years of training and more than a decade of urban combat had taught Reese that there is no graceful way for a grown man to climb through a window. He boosted himself up and rolled forward through the opening. The Glock came out, and Reese slowly and painstakingly cleared his home, room by room and closet by closet. Moving into Lucy's room, Reese removed his helmet and sat on the tiny bed, surrounded by relics of her short time on Earth. As his eyes adjusted to the darkness, he took in the sights and smells of his little girl's sanctuary. Her room was perfectly intact, as if some invisible force had protected it from the hundreds of indiscriminately fired rounds that shredded the rest of their home. As he sat there among his daughter's belongings, it was as if nothing bad had ever happened. A tiny ceramic impression of her newborn footprint sat on a shelf next to a framed photograph of their young family taken at her christening. He stood smiling in his only suit, holding Lucy in her heirloom gown. A beaming Lauren stood by his side in a black dress that complemented her fit frame, her arm around Reese's back. Damn, she looked beautiful. The photo brought him back to those 2 weeks of leave following a past deployment, when he was able to spend nearly every day with the two loves of his life. Looking back on it now, it was the happiest time of his life. Reese knew that he would never feel such happiness, pride, or contentment again. On Lucy's bed was a camouflage Team 7 blanket with her name, date of birth, and weight embroidered on it in pink. A gift from his troop. He ran his hand across the smooth fabric,
feeling the threads where her name was written, just like he was touching the blonde curls on her head. He sat there for hours, taking in the sights and smells of his past in silent meditation. He didn't let outside thoughts invade his tranquility. This was time with his family. Reese made a few stops at various stores in San Diego the next day. A tuxedo shop, two electronics stores, a fabric retailer, and a hardware store. He paid cash for everything just to slow down any investigations that could be underway. He purchased a white tuxedo vest, a yard of white nylon fabric, heavyweight thread, a box of 3-inch framing nails, insulated copper wire, a small wired light bulb, a silicone-controlled rectifier, a safe arm switch, a 9-volt battery, and 3 prepaid cell phones. Reese laid out the items from his shopping trip on the kitchen table of the safe house alongside Lauren's sewing machine, which he dug out of Lucy's closet after his vigil in her room. The Bernina machine had been a gift from his mother. Lauren, God love her, was not one for sewing, and he was sure that she'd never so much as plugged it in. He laid the white tuxedo vest on the table face down next to 2 M112 1.25-pound blocks of C4 plastic explosive. Using a fixed blade, Reese cut the wrapping from the 2 explosive blocks to expose the clay-like contents. The 2 blocks were combined into a single mass, which Reese rolled flat using a rolling pin. C4 is an extremely stable explosive that would need a lot more than a rolling pin to set it off. Even so, modifying military explosives was technically a violation of more than a few regulations, and having seen the mangled bodies of insurgents whose homemade concoctions went off ahead of schedule, Reese took his time. Pushing those thoughts aside, he continued to shape the mass until he was satisfied with its size and thickness. The nails came in strips of 25, designed to feed into a carpenter's nail gun. Reese placed the nail strips on top of the explosive and pressed them into the surface until the entire face was covered with steel. He then moved the explosive sheet onto the vest and covered it with the white nylon fabric. Using scissors, he cut the material until it covered the deadly mix and pinned it in place. This was going to be the hard part. Reese hadn't used a sewing machine since 9th grade home economics class, and he wasn't exactly a master at it then. Nearly every military unit had men who were gifted at sewing. Before the war created an entire industry of custom tactical nylon-focused gear companies, SEAL parachute riggers trained in sewing to repair parachutes would make side money customizing nylon gear for their teammates. Unfortunately, Reese had never spent much time in the rigger's loft learning that particular skill. The good news was that it didn't have to be pretty. It just had to hold everything together. After watching several YouTube videos on the basics of sewing, he fed the vest fabric into the machine. Reese was confident that his future career would not be as a tailor, but he got the job done, leaving a small opening on the bottom right-hand corner of the nylon. He tied off the heavy thread to secure the stitches. He held the vest upright to test his work, and to his relief, everything stayed in place. Next, Reese removed 2 of the 3 prepaid phones from their boxes and plugged both into their wall chargers. He used each phone to call the other to ensure that they functioned, that the numbers were correct, and that any cell phone carrier welcome texts or remote updates had all come through. He had seen even experienced terrorist bomb makers forget to do this and end up splattered across a wall when an unexpected text completed the circuit. Using a white paint marker, Reese drew a large X on one phone and wrote that phone's number on the back of the other. He also entered the phone number as a contact on the 2nd prepaid model. This is where things could get tricky. Reese wished he had an EOD tech to help him, but luckily information that would have been tightly controlled when he first entered the teams was now freely available to the world on the internet. He pried the back from the phone marked with an X and poked around until he could determine which wire did what. He identified those leading to the vibration mechanism and clipped them free of their attachment. twisting the wires from the light bulb onto the vibrator wires and dialing the number that he'd placed into the other phone's contact list. The phone on the table began to ring, illuminating the bulb. Satisfied that sufficient electrical current was flowing from the detached wires, Reese added the safe arm switch, which controlled the flow of electricity from the phone, to the more deadly end of the device, and tested it in the on and off positions to ensure it would break the circuit to the cap. He then wired in the silicone-controlled rectifier designed to hold back the energy until hit with a trickle of electricity that would allow the full charge into the cap. It was always hard for Reese to believe how these basic devices could cause such widespread terror and destruction, how a few hours of shopping could result in a mechanism for war. He disconnected the light and removed the battery from the phone, just to be safe. He then carefully removed a blasting cap from its plastic case and twisted its two wires onto those from the phone and 9-volt, wrapping the connected wires in electrical tape and slipping the device into the vest pocket. He pushed the blasting cap through the hole he'd left in the nylon fabric and buried it into the C4 inside. He double-checked everything to ensure that he hadn't made any errors, then hid the vest under the bed in the second bedroom. He would use the phone plugged into the wall to charge both batteries and would place a battery into the vest phone just before it was ready for use. It would only get called once. Chapter 49, San Diego, California. Wednesday came quickly, though Reese did have a chance to rest, regroup, and reflect on his personal jihad. He did not question the righteousness of his cause. His only prayer was that he get to the end of his list before the authorities or the tumor took his life. Prioritize and execute. Reese hoped he looked the part. What did a master's business student taking an elective in comparative religion look like anyway? Reese had spent a year at the Naval Postgraduate School studying defense analysis with an emphasis on combating terrorism and asymmetrical warfare. He remembered his professors wearing a lot of tweed coats, so he picked one up, along with some non-prescription horned-rimmed glasses. A leather crossbody satchel completed the look. Reese tried to put on his least menacing expression before exiting his land cruiser and heading toward the mosque, passing an auto body shop and an abandoned warehouse as he walked. It wasn't the best part of town, but it wasn't the worst. Just a neglected neighborhood that you would move out of as soon as you had the chance. Reese felt naked leaving his pistol in the car, but he didn't know if he would be frisked before meeting Masood or if he would have to walk through a metal detector. If it had been a legitimately sanctioned mission, he would have forwarded those questions to his intelligence department in the form of an RFI, or request for information. But not having his accustomed support network, he was on his own to improvise. The satchel held the instrument of Masood's impending death. Reese just hoped he could get in front of the imam alone. The target package had stressed that in order to maintain credibility and cover for action, the mosque was a legitimate force for good, performing religious services in accordance with moderate Islamic doctrine, officiating marriages, offering family counseling services, and helping San Diego's downtrodden. That their masjid's moderate outward stance was really a front for ISIS would have surprised more than a few of the faithful. Reese wondered what those Muslims who willingly gave money to Masood in accordance with the third pillar of Islam would do if they knew it was going to further the radical militant branch of their religion in the guise of charity. Approaching the mosque along an avenue with more than a few burnt-out streetlights, Reese found himself walking down a different street in a different war, the streets of Baghdad's Al-Jihad neighborhood in the Al-Rashid district, 2006. After the Al-Askari mosque bombing in February, the country had descended into anarchy. Sunni on Shia violence escalated to the point of civil war, with bodies stacking up in the streets by the thousands, making an already tumultuous situation even more chaotic. Reese had been assigned to a CIA covert action program at the height of the insurgency, a small group of American advisors running a top-tier Iraqi special operations force. Even though Iraq was technically a sovereign country and the unit was Iraqi and totally off the books as far as the United States was officially concerned, they still had to get permission from both senior U.S. military leaders and CIA officials to enter mosques because of the political constraints of having U.S. personnel assigned in an advisory role. In the midst of that carnage, Reese's team had tracked a high-value individual to a mosque in the early morning hours and had him fixed with human assets on the ground and technical surveillance in the air. Mosques were routinely used by the enemy as places of sanctuary, where they could plan and hide with impunity. Even though the law of armed conflict clearly stated that a religious site would lose its immunity if it were used for a military purpose, U.S. senior military and political leaders were so scared of the fallout from hitting a religious site that they, in effect, allowed the enemy to plan attacks against U.S. forces from them without fear of reprisal. The insurgents knew it and took full advantage. Reese had used the gray area in which his unit operated to skirt that technicality and had thrown the enemy off base with a highly successful campaign focused on targeting the insurgents where they felt safe and secure. The CIA side of the house, along with their attorneys, were in full support. But when the senior army general in Iraq found out about the program, he had his chief of staff read Reese the Riot Act. He demanded Reese call him for approval if they needed to hit someone using a mosque as refuge, which is how Reese and his team ended up waiting for more than an hour as the general took his time deciding if he should grant permission for Reese's predominantly Iraqi unit to enter the entirely Iraqi mosque. That delay provided enough time for enemy elements in the al-Jihad neighborhood to surreptitiously surround Reese's small force. Unfortunately for the enemy, Reese had quietly moved snipers into overwatch, had multiple aircraft circling, and a QRF of Bradley fighting vehicles staged four blocks away. What could have been a surgical spec ops direct action capture-kill mission turned into a 40-minute gun battle. Miraculously, Reese's force emerged relatively unscathed. Perhaps that is where Reese's distrust of senior officers began. Tonight's crusade was personal and had nothing to do with sensitivity toward Islam or the law of armed conflict. Tonight was different. Reese was under no constraints. He was unhindered by rules, regulations, laws, or societal norms. He was on the warpath, and his appetite for revenge was insatiable. Hamadi Ismail Massoud had facilitated the worst loss of life in U.S. special operations history. And tonight, he was going to pay. Chapter 50. Reese passed a vacant lot filled with weeds and approached the small domed building from the sidewalk, joining two other worshippers headed inside for evening prayer. He attempted to slouch his shoulders a bit in an effort to look less threatening as he passed a wrought iron gate and walked up the entrance steps. A young, Middle Eastern-looking man occupied an office just inside the building to the right, with a sign in English reading, "Welcome, Front Office."
Excuse me? Reese said.
"Yes," he responded cordially, rising from his desk and approaching Reese.
"Assalamu alaikum,"
he said, using the traditional Arabic "Peace be upon you" greeting, which Reese had heard many times the world over.
"Wa alaikum assalam,"
Reese responded, shaking hands and then touching his right hand to his heart.
"I'm Draper Kaufman from USD. I have an appointment with Imam Massoud after evening prayer. I was invited to observe tonight as well, but don't know exactly what to do," he continued with a warm smile.
"Ah, yes. You are the master's student from USD. It is our pleasure to host you tonight. The prayer room for men is downstairs. We have another for women upstairs. Please remove your shoes. You may observe from the back of the room, and then afterward, Imam Massoud will talk with you about the virtues of Islam and the noble work of the center, as well as answer any other questions you may have."
I hate to impose. Thank you so much for having me. This comparative religion class is part of my international business program, but I am really excited about it. We do this all the time, so it is no imposition. In fact, community outreach is one of the guiding principles of the center.
Reese descended the narrow staircase. Donations certainly had not been used to update the facility. Reese guessed that the humble surroundings were what drew many of the patrons to this particular Islamic center. There were only about a dozen people preparing for evening prayer when Reese entered the room. They were performing the ritual ablution at a large round sink, washing in accordance with traditional Islamic practice. Reese skipped the washing and took his place in the observation area behind the congregants. All were men in conservative dress. A few more than half looked to be of Middle Eastern ancestry, with the remainder a mix of African Americans and Caucasians. The room was exceptionally clean and sparse, which allowed those gathered to clear their minds and arrange their prayer mats facing east toward Mecca. Reese recognized Masood immediately from the target package photos and YouTube videos he had studied in preparation for this evening's mission. Masood took his place as imam at the front of the assembly and began the salat in Arabic. Reese's Arabic language skills were terrible, but he knew enough to recognize a few words and phrases. Masood began with Allahu Akbar, reciting the traditional opening and then transitioning the service through the different phases of prayer, standing, bowing, prostrating, and sitting. Reese knew this ceremony was the formal way of subjecting oneself to and remembering Allah. There was a certain beauty to the service, a focus and devotion that Reese couldn't help but admire. There was no doubt that there was a crisis in Islam, and it was playing out on the world stage in a spectacle of violence. Reese had experience with Muslims running the gamut from those who were Muslim in name only to those who adhered to the pillars and tenets of Islam as best they could, similar to Christians who went to church on Christmas and Easter, right down the line to those Muslims who had been indoctrinated by an archaic ideology of hate that pursued a political agenda and would stop at nothing short of seeing all non-believers put to the sword. Those were the ones who could only be stopped with a bullet to the head, and at accomplishing that, Reese was exceptionally good. Masood finished with the taslim, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, before quietly making his way to the back to greet Reese. Mr. Kaufman, he said in a heavily British-influenced Pakistani accent, welcome to the center. Thank you for coming. Thank you for having me. The salat was beautiful. I have always respected the value and ritual of daily prayer. It would be a better world if more people took the time to give thanks and remembrance as you do. Thank you. That is why we are here, to give believers a safe place in which to practice the facets of Islam and raise awareness about the pillars of our faith. Please join me in my office where we can have tea and continue our discussion. Reese followed Masood back up the stairs and down a short hallway to his small office, stopping at the front of the mosque to say goodnight to the man who had greeted Reese upon his arrival and was just getting ready to depart. Masood moved with a fluid grace that belied his 55 years of age. His hair was black and cut short, which contrasted with the gray of his close-cropped beard. He wore earth-toned slacks and a long-sleeved button-up shirt without a collar, instead of the more traditional thob, probably in the spirit of Southern California inclusiveness. Please take a seat, Masood said, gesturing to one of two modest chairs in front of his desk, as he set an old teapot on a single-burner electric hot plate on a small table positioned against the wall. An improvised tea-making station. Reese wondered how it hadn't burned the place to the ground yet. The room seemed to Reese what he presumed the office of a professor at an underfunded community college would look like. There were stacks of papers on the desk and a small bookshelf behind it, adorned with what appeared to be numerous religious texts. The walls were bare, save for one framed work of Islamic calligraphy. Masood noticed Reese looking at the painting.
Beautiful, isn't it? It's a rendition of a Mir Ali Harawi Tabrizi. brilliant calligrapher from the 15th century. It is a reminder that the Islamic Golden Age was really not that long ago.
I thought the Golden Age ended earlier than that, offered Rhys.
Some scholars would suggest that, but the evidence proves it lasted up through the 16th century. This is to remind me of how far we have fallen and how much work there is to be done. Call it inspiration. He smiled. The Holy Quran states that God does not change the condition of a people until they change what is in their hearts. My calling is to help change what is in their hearts. Now, how can I assist you this evening?
Well, first of all, thank you for taking the time. I'm in a fairly ambitious international business program at USD, and one of my electives is comparative religion. It's a team project, and my part is to interview a well-respected Muslim leader about the current state of Islam in the world today.
Well, that certainly is a topic I spend a lot of my time researching and speaking about at the center and as a guest speaker around the country. As you probably know, Islam is the second largest religion in the world as well as the fastest growing.
Why do you think that is? Rhys inquired.
Islam is a way of life. It is about subjugating oneself to Allah and following the pillars of Islam. It offers a code to live by that is appealing to a mounting number of adherents. It will be our golden age once again, but this time through inclusiveness.
What do you say to those who point to the draconian measures some Islamic countries take to control their populations and force adherence to Sharia law, like throwing homosexuals from buildings to their deaths, flogging young girls who want to go to school, and beheading non-believers?
The role of the center is not to compel non-believers to join Islam. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, says that there is no compulsion in religion, and we certainly do not believe in subordinating U.S. law to Sharia law. Those who practice the abhorrent punishments you mention do nothing but hurt the cause and turn world sentiment against those of us who espouse the true tenets of Islam. We are a religion of peace that some have hijacked for their own self-serving destructive means. In fact, I use Friday prayer to call for peace and unity. I have been condemned by some, but if we are going to live together in harmony, we must learn to accept each other's differences. The United States is the perfect place to show the world how both Muslims and non-Muslims can work and live together in peace. This guy was polished. He had the air and presence of an academic with the charisma of an elder statesman.
Why do you think the intolerant brand of Islam is currently flourishing in the Muslim world? Asked Rhys, trying his best to sound like a grad student.
It saddens me deeply to have to agree with you, Mr. Kaufman. Corrupt politics and sluggish economic conditions plague much of the Muslim world. Radical Islam does not represent the vast, vast majority of Muslims worldwide. And almost all of those killed in Islamic terrorist attacks are, in fact, Muslim, he said, shaking his head. The answers, though, also lie within the religion. Islam was once a force for good throughout the world, and can be again. Education is the key, Mr. Kaufman. Education is the key.
Sir, do you mind if I use my computer to take notes? Asked Rhys.
Not at all. Be my guest.
How are statements about peace, unity, and responsibility, like those you just made, interpreted in the Islamic community at large? Do you worry about your safety?
Rhys continued as he reached into his satchel, removing an old laptop computer. Instead of recycling old computers or selling them, Rhys and Lauren had just stacked them in a closet in the name of data security. This particular one was state-of-the-art back in 1998. He had taken it from his home during the previous night's visit. It was quite a bit larger than today's ubiquitous MacBook Air, and with the keyboard, internal components, and touchpad removed, It fit Reese's Winkler Sayoc tomahawk perfectly. Statements of inclusiveness and tolerance are not always received favorably by those with differing agendas, nor is criticism of Islam, as you are no doubt aware. It pains me to say that other imams have even issued fatwas against me, but those who have done so do not have the legal authority necessary for them to be legitimate, nor do they truly understand the history and intent of a true fatwa. So I feel as safe as one can in these times of trouble.
Reese studied the older man's face. Everything he was saying squared with Reese's studies and first-hand experience in the Muslim world. How could he talk with Reese with such authority and logic about the state of Islam, and then facilitate the same terror he was condemning with such conviction?
How can this guy be such a good liar? He should run for political office.
Hamadi, Reese said, intentionally switching to the imam's first name and wrapping his hand around his tomahawk's maplewood shaft, hidden by the open laptop screen.
Do you know Captain Leonard Howard?
Masood paused, successfully hiding his surprise.
No, that name is not familiar.
Oh, you may have forgotten. He's the Navy attorney that contacted you to arrange the ambush of my SEAL troop in Afghanistan by your friends in the Pakistani Taliban. How much did it cost to have my men killed? This time Masood did not try to feign ignorance or redirect. Instead, he paused and took a deep breath, his eyes narrowing.
Ah, James Reese, I did not recognize you. You look different from your picture in the paper from your wife's and daughter's funeral. The beard suits you well, and the glasses are a nice touch. Too bad your family were kafir, and are now in the fires of hell.
He spat out kafir like it was the most vile word in existence. Reese slowly closed the lid to the laptop and placed his hawk on top. Masood's eyes looked questioningly, almost unbelievably, at the ancient weapon in Reese's hand, and then back to meet Reese's icy stare.
You should be happy, Masood. Dying like this makes you a martyr. Now, that may or may not be true, and it really doesn't matter to me in the least. What matters to me is that you die, just like the true believers you send out to sacrifice themselves for the cause. Tonight, it's your turn.
As Reese stood to deliver his justice, Masood lunged for his desk drawer with surprising speed, bringing out a small CZ-75 compact 9mm pistol. If he had kept it with a round in the chamber, he might have had a chance, but the time it took to reach the slide and chamber a round was more than enough time for Reese's swing to connect with his quarry's hand in its attempt to bring the weapon to bear. With the heaviest part of the tomahawk resting in its head, it hit the inside of Masood's right wrist with its full force, destroying bones, muscles, and tendons, while severing arteries and veins and sending the CZ pistol clattering to the floor. Masood screamed out in pain, grabbing at his right hand, which only remained attached by a thin shred of muscle and skin, smothered in the slippery ooze of its altered state. Reese moved with the precision of a man who was no stranger to violence, unfazed by the coppery scent of fresh blood in the air or the primal screams of the man he had come to kill. It was then that the headache dropped Reese to the ground. The blinding pain was like 1,000 shards of crushed glass grinding together inside his brain. This one lasted longer than his previous episodes, but not long enough for Masood to reach his CZ. It had taken the imam a few seconds to realize that this was his opportunity to escape or go for his pistol. He chose the latter and was two steps into his dash for the gun when Reese's tomahawk buried itself in the back of his upper thigh, sending him crashing to the floor. Coming out of his incapacitation, Reese grabbed a handful of Masood's loose clothing to twist himself upward and swing the hawk down in a powerful arch, terminating in his prey's upper back, just shy of his spine. Using the embedded hawk as a fulcrum, Reese pulled himself into a kneeling position over the broken body beneath him. Reese had to give his adversary credit.
Even with one severed hand, a thigh cut to the bone squirting blood profusely, and a tomahawk embedded in his back, he made one last effort to reach for his weapon with his good hand. Rotating the tomahawk to the side, Reese disengaged it from Masood's back and used it to keep him from his pistol by slamming it down like an angry hammer, cutting off four of Masood's five fingers, which stretched out to claw for the gun. Another blood-curdling scream escaped Masood's lips and was cut short by one last swing of the hawk, the tip of its blade shaped into an evil spike by the master bladesmith who had crafted it for this exact purpose, carving its way through Masood's temple and into his brain, causing a massive intracerebral hemorrhage and making him a martyr for the faith. Reese extracted the tomahawk from Masood's crushed skull and looked to the door. No footsteps in the hall betrayed a visitor. No alarms, nothing to signify anything amiss. Still, Reese had to work fast. Cutting off a head was more work than one would think, even with a razor-sharp tomahawk, and Reese had to press Masood's head into the floor with his left hand while chopping through the neck, gristle, and spine to finally free it from the body with his right. Reese did not relish decapitating a human body, nor did he hesitate or shy from the task. 68 U.S. servicemen were dead because of the conspiracy that this piece of meat helped facilitate. It was time to send a message to the others that he was coming for them, too. Putting the decapitated head into his satchel, Reese moved down the dark hall toward the exit, tomahawk at his side, but ready nonetheless. He paused at the front door, looking outside through the glass. Nothing moved, just gloomy streets in a part of town no one cared much about. Turning off the exterior light, Reese descended the steps toward the sidewalk, pausing only momentarily at the wrought iron gate to impale the head of Imam Hamadi Ismail Masood on a sharp vertical spire, tossing the black flag of ISIS that had been in the package Ben had given him at the safe house over it for good measure. The night's work was just getting started. Chapter 51. Reese needed to regroup. He was not yet done, and he had some preparations to make before launching his next mission. "These damn headaches might just get me killed before I can finish the list," Reese thought as he made his way back to the safe house to refit. Reese took out his notes and the poster board floor plan of Holder's apartment and reviewed them thoroughly. A lot had transpired since his last visit, and he didn't want to rely on his memory. He studied the video he'd shot in the model apartment as well, to ensure he knew the layout back to front. He had continued to practice picking the lock identical to Holder's every chance he got, and had become quite adept at working it not only quickly but also quietly. Stealth would be the key on this one. If he blew it, there would be no hiding what had transpired. He went to his stack of gear in Ben's garage, retrieved his issued Heckler & Koch Mark 24 Mod Zero handgun, and threaded on the long black suppressor. This .45 caliber pistol was the smaller replacement for the old Mark 23, a behemoth of a handgun that was a perfect example of bureaucratic blundering. To create something so heavy and cumbersome that when it came time to go to war, it was left to gather dust in the armory was typical of the military's procurement and acquisition process. He then pulled a length of 550 cord from a kit bag and cut it with the folding knife clipped inside the pocket of his pants. He wet one end of the cord with his mouth and fished it through the lanyard loop molded into the handgun's grip. He ran the other end of the cord around the back of his neck until the suppressed handgun dangled at his belt line. Reese then tied the other end of the cord off and wrapped the large loop repeatedly around the grip before applying a small piece of rigger's tape to hold it in place. He arranged the remainder of the gear he would need and double-checked that everything was in order before loading up the cruiser with what looked to be enough equipment to sustain him through a deployment. Putting on a pair of dark gray running pants, a black fleece pullover, and a pair of lightweight running shoes, he picked up his backpack and headed out the back door. It was a weeknight, and the traffic was almost non-existent at this hour. He steered off I-5 and pulled into the parking lot of the medical office. He turned off the motor and headlights, sitting quietly in the vehicle with the windows down for nearly an hour, taking in the sights and sounds, or lack thereof. He pulled on a set of nitrile gloves and then reached into the pack on the passenger's seat and removed the handgun, unraveling the long loop of cord before slipping it over his head. He unzipped his fleece jacket and dropped the .45 down inside. At 3 o'clock a.m., he climbed out of the vehicle, put on his unzipped pack, and pulled the waistband of his dark workout pants up and over the dangling handgun's suppressor. There's no great way to conceal a suppressed handgun, particularly when you're not wearing a belt. The 550 cord loop kept the gun inside his waistband where it wouldn't flop around, but also allowed him enough slack to fire the gun at a close-range target if the need arose. It wasn't ideal, but it would work. He climbed cautiously over the short chain-link fence, being careful not to let the handgun catch on anything. After crossing the well-lit parking lot, he stopped next to Holder's building and slipped the smaller PVS-18 night vision monoscope attached to what operators referred to as a skull crusher to his head. The skull crusher was essentially a steel headband, sturdy enough to carry the weight of night optics. It was lightweight and less bulky than a helmet, though its downside was how it got its nickname. It hurt your skull like hell. Carefully, he approached Holder's door and listened. I hope this asshole isn't an insomniac. He slipped his picks into the lock and slowly rotated his hands to unlock the door. Thanks to his lube job last time around, the door swung open without making a sound. He stepped into the dark living room of the apartment and quietly shut the door behind him. The pitch-dark room became visible in various shades of green and black as he scanned with the small nightscope. The ambient light in the apartment, from the digital clock on the microwave to the standby light on the television, glowed brightly. Reese drew the suppressed HK and held it at the position of retention against his chest. He stood perfectly still for what he thought was about a minute, listening for any sign that he'd awakened his target, thankfully hearing nothing but the hum of the appliances. He moved slowly down the hallway, conscious of every movement, so as not to make a single unnecessary sound. He reached the door to Holder's bedroom and once again stopped and listened for any sign of movement. Satisfied, he reached out and touched the doorknob with his gloved hand. Turning the knob as slowly as his patience allowed, he cursed silently to himself as barely audible clicking sounds came from inside the doorknob assembly. He opened the door with his left hand while gripping his handgun with the right, his body bladed to the right to make it difficult for someone hiding behind the door to wrestle the gun from him. Josh Holder was lying spread-eagle on his back, wearing only a pair of dark briefs. The sheets were pushed down to the foot of the bed. This guy must get night sweats. Reese stepped into the room slowly, and on top of the dresser, found what he was looking for. Holder's DOD-issued SIG 9mm, tucked inside a Kydex belt holster. The handgun was a smaller version of the one Reese had used during his time with the teams. He had struggled with this part of the plan for days, debating whether to do what was smart or what was just. Shooting Holder with his own gun would look to the investigators like a probable suicide, and would likely buy him a few more days of surprise before the net tightened. On the other hand, he couldn't think of anything more righteous than killing the man who had somehow gotten the drop on Boozer with his friend's beloved cartridge. The fact that the .45 ACP was suppressed was icing on the cake and decreased his chances of being seen or heard as he made his exit. He decided that he'd shoot Holder with the .45, pick up his empty brass, and then leave the man's 9mm lying cocked on his chest with a round missing from the magazine. It wouldn't fool the detectives very long, but then again, it wouldn't have to. Reese was standing over Holder's supine form to determine the best angle for his shot, considering it was supposed to look like a suicide, when Holder emitted a surprising gasp, and his torso catapulted upward to a sitting position, his eyes opened wide. The man's sudden movement startled Reese, who hesitated for a brief moment before shoving the HK suppressor directly into Holder's open mouth. He could feel Holder's teeth shatter from the violent intrusion and quickly squeeze the trigger. The muffled sound was amplified by the acoustics of the small bedroom as Holder's brain splattered instantly against the white drywall, his body collapsing backward onto the bed. Reese didn't panic, but Holder's nightmare certainly startled him. That's for you, Boozer. Reese grabbed Holder's SIG from the dresser, pulling it from its holster, ejecting and retaining a round, and leaving the hammer cocked to make it look as if it had been fired, then dropped it onto Holder's bare chest, picked up his .45 brass, and backed out of the room. He shut the bedroom door and flipped his NODs upward as he hurried toward the front door of the apartment. He wasn't sure if his .45 caliber round had penetrated the drywall and ended up in the neighbor's flat screen or dishwasher, or if it would have been intrusive enough to wake them up at this hour of the night. If it had, Reese figured he had about 30 seconds to spare until that neighbor called 911, came to investigate, or both. He closed Holder's apartment door behind him and pulled his lockpicks out of his pocket, fumbling in his rush and dropping one of the picks to the ground.
Get your shit together, Reese. Relax, work the lock.
He took a deep breath, inserted the picks into the lock, and got the door secured once again. Then, taking off across the parking lot at a dead sprint, he leapt over the fence like an Olympic hurdler. Tossing his pack on the seat, he started the cruiser and slowly drove away from the scene, waiting until he was around the back side of the medical office before he turned on his headlights and pointed his truck in the direction of Orange County. Chapter 52. Capstone Capital Corporate Offices, Los Angeles, California. Steve Horn thrived on being in control, but under the current circumstances, he did not feel in control at all. He sat in his office, unable to summon anyone who could bring him all the answers. His right-hand man, the glue that kept this project together, had died of a drug overdose of all things. The toxicology reports hadn't come back yet, but the detectives were certain it was what was termed a reckless overdose, the same type they saw all too frequently. He checked with his own independent sources in law enforcement, who all confirmed that, yes, this thing walked and talked like a run-of-the-mill prescription drug death. The circle of people in the know on this project was extremely small, as it had to be by necessity. First of all, there was only a finite amount of money to go around. You could only make so many nine-figure promises before running out of equity. Second, the sensitivity on this investment was off the charts. Fewer than a dozen people on the planet knew all of the pieces to this puzzle, and one of them was dead. Horn couldn't help from wondering whether one thing had anything to do with the other. The office door opened suddenly, and his assistant, Kelsey, burst through with a look of panic on her face.
"Mr. Horn, I'm so sorry, but that was Detective Weatherly on the phone. He said that Josh Holder was found dead in his apartment early this morning. They say he shot himself. He was always so sweet to me, Mr. Horn."
She burst into tears and sank into one of the large leather chairs facing Horn's desk, her head in her hands.
"That was no fucking suicide."
Horn grabbed his iPhone and scrolled down to find Marcus Boykin's name. He touched the screen to dial his mobile number and heard it go straight to voicemail. On a hunch, he typed Boykin's name into the search bar on his desktop computer. The first link sent chills down his spine. www.wyomingnews.com. Star Valley man killed in hunting accident. Marcus Boykin, 57, of Star Valley Ranch, was found dead in his vehicle.
"Kelsey, get me Mike Tedesco on the phone, now!"
Chapter 53. Naval Special Warfare Command, Coronado, California. During the drive from his home, Tedesco had accepted his fate as atonement for his actions. His heart was filled with an immense sense of regret for getting himself mixed up in this project in the first place.
Goddamn Steve Horn.
At least his family wouldn't be harmed. In that he found some comfort. In his last act, he had found his courage. Mike Tedesco took a deep breath and opened the door of his Bentley coupe. Despite the lightweight blend of his bespoke Savile Row suit and open collar, he was sweating profusely. His knees were weak as he began the short walk to the building's entrance. The guard inside the door recognized him immediately and handed him a visitor's badge through the slot under the bulletproof glass. Tedesco walked the halls in a fog, unable to focus or wash the blank look of despair from his face. Those who recognized him
regarded him with great curiosity. The man who usually walked these halls with an aristocratic air of confidence, great charm, and an impeccable appearance, now looked like he was on his way to the gallows. The admiral's aide rose from his desk as Tedesco walked past him to open the doors into Pilsner's office.
"Mr. Tedesco, is the admiral expecting you?" he asked in vain as Tedesco opened the paneled door and walked inside.
Admiral Pilsner was sitting behind his desk in a starched khaki uniform, his nose still bandaged but the deep black eyes fading out to a grotesque purple and yellow. The look on his face indicated surprise. It wasn't like Mike to drop by without his assistant calling ahead first to arrange it. He was even more surprised at Tedesco's disheveled appearance. Tedesco stopped a few feet short of Pilsner's desk, just as the admiral's aide stumbled through the door behind him.
"Sir, I'm sorry, I tried to intercept him."
"It's okay. Mr. Tedesco is always welcome in my office, you know that. Have a seat, Mike. What's the problem? You look terrible."
Just then, a cell phone began to ring from inside Tedesco's coat. The ringer was set to sound like an old-fashioned dial telephone. Ring. Ring.
"Mr. Tedesco, you can't have a cell phone in this building," cried the aide, who strictly obeyed the security protocols of WARCOM.
Tedesco retrieved the phone, which appeared to be a cheap, prepaid model, and held it across the table for Admiral Pilsner.
"It's for you, Gerald,"
he said in a tone that haunted the room. The admiral accepted it with disbelief and looked at the phone, dumbfounded, as if he'd never seen one before. Slowly, he put it up to his ear.
"Hello? Who is this?"
Mike Tedesco closed his eyes. This was to be his penance.
"This is your executioner, you fucking disgrace. You wiped out my troop and my family, and you did it all for money and a promotion. I'll see you in hell, motherfucker."
James Reese hit send on a second cell phone, connecting a call to the one strapped to Mike Tedesco. The phone received the incoming call and sent a burst of electrons to a cluster of wires leading to a blasting cap loaded with PETN. The blasting cap detonated and forced a high explosive response from the 2.5 pounds of C4 sewn inside the suicide vest worn underneath Tedesco's dress shirt. Tedesco's body tamped the force of the explosion, forcing all the energy forward toward Admiral Pilsner's desk. That energy turned the strips of framing nails embedded in the face of the C4 into red-hot shrapnel, moving it well beyond the speed of sound, shredding Admiral Pilsner's face and upper torso like a dozen shotgun rounds. The blast sent chunks of his charred skull through the massive windows, which exploded instantly from the overpressure, propelling thousands of shards of glass onto the beautiful beach below. Tedesco's body was cut completely in half by the blast, and the parts of Admiral Pilsner that extended above his massive wooden desk simply ceased to exist. Reese set down the cell phone on the late Mike Tedesco's dining room table and looked at Tedesco's widow, who sat just feet away gently rocking their newborn infant. Janet Tedesco quickly went back to stroking her baby's head, but she thought she detected a hint of sadness in the big man's eyes. When she looked back up, he was gone. Chapter 54, San Diego, California. Leonard Howard had been somewhat of a failure in the civilian practice of law. He did well academically in law school, but was unprepared for the chaotic workload of a civil litigator. He also found that despite his dreams to the contrary, he was abysmal in the courtroom. Whenever the partners would send him in to cover a routine motion hearing, he would panic. His confidence would shatter, his mouth would go powder dry, and his voice would crack. He was quickly let go from the firm and found himself adrift. There was only one place where a lazy lawyer who was scared of the courtroom could thrive: government service. A law school friend told him about the Navy JAG program, and he was immediately sold. The uniform brought him instant pride and prestige, and the complicated bureaucracy of the military gave him an environment in which to excel. He particularly loved signing his emails, "Judge," an unauthorized way to psychologically elevate himself through the electronic communications medium. More than two decades into his uniformed service, Howard had risen to the rank of captain and was the Judge Advocate General of the Naval Special Warfare Command. When his friends and neighbors in the San Diego